Welcome to Washington Today on C-SPAN Radio for Friday, July 30th, 2021. Here are some of your headlines. It is looking likely that the federal moratorium on evictions put in place to help renters who fell behind on rent due to economic hardships of the coronavirus pandemic, that moratorium due to expire this weekend, it looks like it will expire. As attempts by congressional Democrats to pass a bill to extend it, not finding the Democratic votes needed to pass. White House reacting to the leaked CDC memo, which says that the Delta variant is as easily transmissible among the vaccinated as the unvaccinated. A bipartisan call for President Biden to name a border czar to handle immigration issues, and the suggestion for the position, former Homeland Security Secretary Jay Johnson. And the International Olympic Committee responding to a U.S. senator's claim that a star American pole vaulter's positive COVID test was a false positive and unfairly took him out of competition for a likely medal. Reporting at TheHill.com, House Democratic leaders failed to round up enough votes Friday to pass legislation extending the federal ban on evictions just 2 days before it was set to expire. Two Democratic lawmakers said that a possible House floor vote on Friday would ultimately be scrapped after leadership struggled all day to round up enough support. "We don't have the votes," a Democratic aide said. But when Speaker Pelosi was asked if she had pulled the bill, she said no. Speaker Pelosi initially looked for an extension until December 31st, then tried an extension to October 18th. But again, this from the Hill newspaper, the vote count fell far short amid resistance from moderates and housing industry groups. At a news conference, Speaker Pelosi asked why this issue was put off until just before the deadline.
We're in a situation where the pandemic has, of course, taken its new shape. As we've talked before, these viruses are resourceful. When they are transmitted, they mutate, and that makes it more of a challenge. We know that that is what we are faced with now. And so the Center for Disease Control has talked a new way about mask wearing, about that urging vaccination and the rest. The moratorium for eviction is a COVID initiative related to the intensity of the issue. And for $46 billion was allocated both in the year-end omnibus last December as well as in the rescue package, $46 billion. This money has largely gone out to the states and local governments to implement and to give to the renters so they can pay the rent, which helps the landlords, of course, too. And the fact is that almost $50 billion was allocated, $46 billion. Less than 10% of that has been spent. Around $3 billion is reported to me, but let's say it would be 10%. Why should the renters be punished for the fact that the system did not put money in their pockets to pay the rent to the landlords? So that's where we come to this. It's like, well, CDC, you have defined this, and these people have not gotten the money. So I think this is something that will work out. It isn't about any more money. The money is there, resting in localities and governor's offices across the country. So we would like the CDC to expand the moratorium. That's where it can be done. And then, and of course, with the public message of governors, mayors, et cetera, give the money for its purpose to the renters. So this is to me a very an imperative that it be done, and that as I say, timing is not everything on this, except that the moratorium ends. But again, if they know that the money will be released, then we'll go there. There are all kinds of talk among lawyers who thought this and that in the executive branch. I don't know. I don't want to be critical of what they have because they just made the statement yesterday. But we're not going away from this issue, whether it's now or shortly thereafter. Have you ever seen an eviction? Sometimes even the law enforcement people go into these apartments are crying because they know they're going to do something that's going to put babies' cribs out on the street, personal belongings out on the street. It happens like that. Passersby can even take that stuff. These people have been evicted, now have to find another place to live, to take this stuff that's now been on the street. It is the most heart-wrenching and so in defiance of everything that we say we are about in the Gospel of Matthew. When I was needed shelter, you gave it to me, that the words of the Lord. So I think that this is something that fairness and justice has to be done. We'll ensure that it does.
House Speaker Nancy Pelosi at a news conference. The Center on Budget and Policy Priorities says the end of the eviction moratorium could affect 11.4 million adult renters who are behind on rent. At the White House, the Principal Deputy Press Secretary, Karine Jean-Pierre, asked about this last-minute push for an extension and the request by Speaker Pelosi for the CDC to extend the eviction moratorium.
Lawmakers are scrambling to find a legislative solution, but Speaker Pelosi said today that she'd like to see the CDC extended. I know you all have cited the Supreme Court decision as the reason Congress needs to deal with it, but why not just extend it, have that legal fight, and give Congress a little bit more room to work?
So as we've stated, Alex, and to your point about Pelosi, you know, the Supreme Court said it could only be extended with congressional authorization. That was their decision. That's how they were able to strike it down, and that's what they said needed to happen. And so this bill that Pelosi is asking for, this would meet that requirement if successful. So this is important. It's incredibly important to move forward. And so the administration is going to work together with leaders in Congress on potential avenues to extend the eviction moratorium to protect these vulnerable renters and their families. We understand how critical that is, how important that is. It has been a lifeline to so many Americans here. So this is a public health concern, as you can imagine, that we think should be supported by both Republicans and Democrats. So we support the Speaker's effort, and we will do everything that we can to move this forward.
The White House Deputy Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre in the White House briefing room. Back to Capitol Hill, the House Rules Committee did start work on a bill to extend the eviction moratorium deadline until December 31st, even as it was not clear that it could get enough Democratic votes to pass, assuming Republicans would oppose. And in fact, testifying at the Rules Committee hearing opposing the extension, Congresswoman Kathy McMorris Rogers, the ranking member of the Energy and Commerce Committee.
I oppose this rushed and unnecessary bill you're considering today. Last year, at the height of the pandemic, for the purpose of reducing the spread of COVID-19, the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention issued a nationwide moratorium on evictions. In the past 18 months, this moratorium has been extended several times by CDC. However, in May this year, the DC District Court ruled that the CDC had exceeded its authority by imposing the moratorium in June. The Supreme Court ruled that the current moratorium, which expires tomorrow, could not be extended absent clear and specific authorization by Congress on the CDC's authority. I oppose this rushed partisan legislation for several reasons. First, the bill before us does not provide clear and specific clarification on CDC's authority. It simply extends the CDC's moratorium based on an authority the courts have ruled does not exist. The reason this bill simply extends the unlawful order is because it was written last night at the last minute, despite the White House and congressional Democrats' full knowledge for over a month that this moratorium would lapse absent congressional action. If this was truly a necessity, we should have been holding hearings and markups to clarify CDC's authority. I also have grave concerns about continuing to empower the CDC to shut down entire industries and attempt to control the everyday lives of Americans. The CDC and the Biden administration's attempt to mandate masks and vaccines using secret, unpublished, and questionable data is unacceptable, and we should not double down on this agency's failings by further empowering them to command and control. Finally, the moratorium is completely unnecessary. Unlike last year when it was first imposed, we have a widely available vaccine, and deaths and hospitalizations have plummeted nationwide. Congress has also enacted to provide almost $50 billion in emergency rental aid through various COVID relief packages, but only $3 billion has been spent. Instead of pushing through this last-minute power grab, I would urge my Democrat colleagues to focus on holding the Biden administration accountable, as Republican leader McHenry has been attempting to do for months, and ensure that the money gets to the people who need it. I unfortunately urge rejection of this misguided bill, and I yield back.
Congresswoman Kathy McMorris Rodgers before the House Rules Committee, which did not finish work on the eviction moratorium extension bill in order to bring it to the full House for a vote. And while that was happening, CNN reporting, even if the extension passes the House, it's unlikely the Senate would be able to quickly pass the bill anytime soon. The upper chamber has tied up the floor for the foreseeable future as it tries to advance a bipartisan infrastructure bill, and any quick passage would require unanimous consent from all 100 senators. So as this program, Washington Today, airs early Friday evening, no congressional action on extending the moratorium yet, and the House is about to begin a month-long August recess. On Wall Street today, the Dow was down 149, NASDAQ down 105, S&P down 23. Story in the Washington Post Thursday night revealing an internal memo from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention urging health officials to acknowledge the war has changed when it comes to the coronavirus, citing unpublished data showing vaccinated people may transmit the Delta variant just as easily as unvaccinated people. White House Deputy Press Secretary Karine Jean-Pierre asked if the memo contradicts the president's statements that the nation is now in the middle of a pandemic of the unvaccinated.
Our message has always been clear throughout. We need more people to get vaccinated to stop the spread of this variant. And so we have to continue to make that effort. Vaccinated and unvaccinated people infected with Delta have higher viral loads, meaning more virus in their body than with previous variants. The last two did not have that. And so this is what we're seeing in the Delta. High viral loads mean you are more likely to spread it. So in the rare occasions that vaccinated people get Delta in a breakthrough infection, they may be contagious. And this is what we heard from CDC this week. And so the most important takeaway, and I want to be really clear about this because this is critical for all of you who report about this and for those who are watching. We should have, the takeaways we should have from this guidance and any follow-up reporting is actually pretty simple. We need more people to get vaccinated. That's the answer. We need more people to get vaccinated. That's if we want to stop the spread of this variant and avoid mutations, we can.
Karine Jean-Pierre, the White House Deputy Press Secretary. CDC releasing research today about a COVID-19 outbreak in Massachusetts, concluding that vaccinated people who got so-called breakthrough infections carried about the same amount of the coronavirus as those who did not get the shots. Study's authors say the findings suggest the CDC's mask guidance should be expanded to include the entire country, even outside of hot spots. Assistant Health and Human Services Secretary Dr. Rachel Levine asked today if at some point, COVID variants will outpace vaccine effectiveness.
So another unsettling piece of news recently came from the CDC director, who thought that the virus could only be a few mutations away from a variant that could potentially escape vaccines. How, you know, speaking as a scientist, I've asked you as a pediatrician, how does that inform your thinking going ahead? And how should it inform messaging to people who are still hesitant about taking vaccines?
Well, whenever the virus, it has significant immunity spread and transmission, and there's lots of cases, then you can see the development of variants. It has to do with how the virus evolved. And so the way to actually decrease the amount of variants that we would see would be to increase our vaccination program in the United States and to increase the vaccination programs across the world. I think that it should inform people about the importance of getting vaccinated now. We have a tremendous safety record with these vaccines. Almost 350 million doses of the vaccines have been given in the United States and countless millions more across the country. They have a remarkable safety profile. And we know that they are effective against the Delta variant in terms of people getting very sick, in terms of being hospitalized, et cetera. And so now is the time for people to get vaccinated. And that's the best way to protect against the development of these variants.
Dr. Rachel Levine, Assistant Health and Human Services Secretary, interviewed by Washington Post senior national reporter Frances Stead Sellers. The $1.2 trillion bipartisan infrastructure spending bill overcoming another procedural hurdle in the U.S. Senate. Although the Associated Press is writing the effort got off to a haphazard start on Friday, shortly after the Senate began the procedural vote, it was stopped. Senator John Thune, Republican, indicated Republicans would need to see the full text of the bill before agreeing to go forward. Moments later, the vote resumed, and the effort to proceed to consideration of the bill passed by a vote of 66 to 28. As the Senate bill is proceeding, it's also getting support in the House from the bipartisan Problem Solvers Caucus. The caucus leaders are Republican Brian Fitzpatrick of Pennsylvania and Democrat Josh Gottheimer of New Jersey.
Basically, what we're here to say is this work that everybody's put, the legislation that a lot of people put a lot of work into that's being drafted right now is a really pragmatic solution. It's something that we all support, and we want it to be brought here as a standalone vote. We're not going to get into speculation about various different iterations that may or may not transpire, other than to say thank you to all of our colleagues here. We're in a very good place, and Josh, I yield to you.
Thanks so much. Thanks, Fitz. Brian, thanks for your excellent leadership. You know, we stand here today surrounded by Democrats and Republicans from the House and the Senate. I think we can all agree this week's vote to move forward, the largest infrastructure investment in the country's history, marked a huge win for the American people and for every single district in our country, including mine in northern New Jersey, from addressing lead in children's drinking water to building tunnels to repairing our crumbling roads, bridges, and rails to getting out more broadband and electric vehicles. This bipartisan infrastructure package will help create jobs, build our economy, address our climate, enable us to compete, and deliver on what the Problem Solvers Caucus really is all about, that indeed we can govern together, that bipartisanship and civility are alive and well, and that when we work together, there's no problem we can't solve. As President Biden said it when he was sworn in just a few feet from here, that we must end this uncivil war that pits red against blue, rural versus urban, conservative versus liberal. We're not there yet, of course, but I'm confident that when this bill gets sent to the House from the Senate, and with the President and the White House firmly behind it, we will take it up quickly for a strong, standalone, bipartisan vote, because that's what the country wants.
Outside the U.S. Capitol, the leaders of the Bipartisan Problem Solvers Caucus, Democrat Josh Gottheimer, Republican Brian Fitzpatrick. The standalone vote they referred to references that Speaker Pelosi says she'll not take up the bipartisan infrastructure spending bill until a second larger budget bill funding Democratic social spending priorities is also passed by the Senate and sent to the House, and that second bill expected to be opposed by Republicans. Senate Majority Leader Chuck Schumer saying he thinks the Senate can finish the bipartisan infrastructure spending bill in a couple of days. President Joe Biden highlighting part of the bipartisan infrastructure bill, meeting with governors virtually to discuss wildfires.
But we're in for a long fight yet this year, and the only way we're going to meet those challenges is by working together. Wildfires are a problem for all of us, and we have to stay closely coordinated in doing everything we can for our people. That's why I asked the governors to join us, Democrats and Republicans alike, so they can update me and the vice president directly on what they need and what we can possibly do more of. And so we can discuss what's needed today to meet an urgent danger at hand, a plan for what we can do to make sure we're better prepared next time. One of the important aspects of the bipartisan infrastructure deal that is before the Senate now is that it includes billions of dollars to strengthen wildfire preparedness, resilience, and response. It includes funding for prevention efforts like forest management and to restore millions of acres of high-risk areas to protect homes and public water sources for drinking. And overlaying all of this is the necessity to successfully confront climate change. We have some significant changes we're making in these two pieces of legislation that, God willing, will pass in the next month or so. But we can't ignore how the overlapping and intertwined factors of extreme heat, prolonged drought, and supercharged wildfire conditions are affecting the country. And so this is a challenge that demands our urgent, urgent action, both today and, as you all know better than anyone else in the country, not just today, but tomorrow, next year, and the year after.
President Joe Biden at his online meeting with Western state governors, both Republicans and Democrats. Also joining them, Vice President Kamala Harris to discuss wildfires. The National Interagency Fire Center says this season, 67 large fires burning nearly 1 million acres. That's over 1,400 square miles across 12 states. President Biden says that he supports, including in that second infrastructure bill he mentioned, the budget bill, a path to citizenship for millions of undocumented immigrants. He made that clear on Thursday after meeting with members of the Congressional Hispanic Caucus and other pro-immigration lawmakers. And today, Congressman Henry Cuellar, a Democrat who represents a Texas border district, and Senator Lindsey Graham, Republican, urging the president to name a border czar, suggesting former Homeland Security Secretary Jay Johnson.
I'm sure
he's listening to us on that. Yeah, look, I have his contact. I have reached out. It's been a little busy. I've been getting home about 11 o'clock. Look. First of all, we're not criticizing anybody that deals with the border, but we do need a new set of eyes. You know, businesses do it all the time. Hey, let's bring an outside person to come in and give us a new eyes. We've had a border czar. If you recall, we'd had Roberta Jacobson. In my opinion, she did great in Central America. Being border, I think that might have been a little different, and she's not there. We don't have a border czar. We've had border czars in the past. And I think bringing somebody like Jay Johnson, and I think you heard me, I've always said Jay Johnson as the senator and I, we said, we agree on him. And he was compassionate, but he followed the law. And look, and one of the things he did, and I know we had a lot of conversations, and you mentioned also, was look, you know, if somebody needs to stay here, has to stay, he stays. But if somebody, he or she has to be returned, he returned. We see images. You know, you can't just talk about people coming over, but we see images of people coming in. Has anybody ever seen a single picture or video or image of somebody being returned? They don't want to show that because, unfortunately, they don't want to offend the immigration activists. And I've always said, it's good to have immigration activists, but you also have border communities, and you heard from them directly, border communities and the men and women of DHS. So what we're saying is, you know, Jay Johnson would be, we haven't talked to him, but somebody like him would be good. Somebody who has his credentials would be good. But in my opinion, and I think also the senator, Jay Johnson understood it. He wrote the playbook, if you think about it.
And let me just add that I've been involved in a bipartisan way trying to fix this problem. If they try to put DACA in the $3.5 trillion infrastructure bill, it'll blow up any hope of bipartisanship for a very long time to come. I think what we should do is we should have an asylum reform fix. People are coming here. We canceled the Remain in Mexico policy. Now people are coming here making asylum claims, and they're being released, and they don't show up. People being released without a court date, 50,000 people. Guess what? None of them are showing up. I don't blame them. I blame us. So what I'd like to do is repair the asylum loophole, plug it for a while, try to find some ways to better secure the border, and for that, maybe we can do DACA and TPS. You just got to slow down the flow. You got to have a timeout on these illegal crossings. You got to give these communities along the border some hope and breathing space before you break them.
Senator Lindsey Graham and Congressman Henry Cuellar taking reporters' questions. Senator Day also confirmed a new director of USCIS, U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services. Jadu is the person's name. Washington Today continues in a minute. Well, welcome back to Washington Today. A few more headlines. Former President Donald Trump telling top officials in the Justice Department about the 2020 presidential election results, quote, just say that the election was corrupt and leave the rest to me. That, according to notes taken by former acting Attorney General Jeffrey Rosen's deputy, Richard Donahue, during a call among Trump, Rosen, and Donahue December 27th, documents released by the House Oversight and Reform Committee. And 6 months into Democrats controlling the White House and the House and the Senate, a new poll finding 6 in 10 Democrats say they are optimistic about their party's future. and Democrats nearly universally, 92%, approving of the way President Biden is handling his job. But the party is divided over the best strategy for accomplishing the agenda. About half say Democrats should compromise with Republicans, even if it means giving up things they want. The other half say Democrats should stick to their positions no matter what, even if it means that they would have to find a way to pass laws without Republican support. The Biden administration's first evacuation flight for Afghans who aided Americans and other coalition forces arriving in the U.S., reports Bloomberg, as the administration steps up efforts to relocate interpreters, other military assistants, and their families ahead of a final troop withdrawal. The plane carrying more than 200 people landed at Fort Lee in Virginia, where passengers were to undergo health screenings and further processing of their special immigrant visas. Senator Tim Kaine of Virginia speaking to reporters today outside the U.S. Capitol building.
2 a.m. this morning, 200 Afghans came into Dulles Airport in Virginia, and after quick processing there, they went to Fort Lee, a fort about 30 miles south of where I live, in the Tri-Cities area near Petersburg, Virginia. There's a hotel that's relatively new on that base that will be used as a processing center for up to 2,500 Afghans at a time. The expectation is once they come into Dulles, they'll be transferred to Fort Lee for prompt processing. Many of them need to have medical exams completed before they can be relocated with families and in communities around the United States. There's already 70,000 Afghan SIVs in the United States, and so there's many communities across the country that have, you know, strong pockets of Afghan communities. And so many of these who are processed at Fort Lee will go into these communities, including communities in Virginia where there's already a strong Afghan presence. I am proud to be a senator and an Armed Service Committee member from Virginia because we are the state that is most closely connected to the nation's military mission, our installations, our military history, but especially our people. One out of every 9 Virginians is a veteran. And then if you add to that Guard, active, reserve, DOD civilian, DOD contractor, DOD families. My son is a Marine reservist after 8 years as Marine active duty. You get to a Virginia that's not 1 out of 9, but 1 out of every 2 or 3 Virginians has a direct connection to our nation's military mission. And we feel particularly supportive and even proud that we can be the initial place of touching soil in the United States as these Afghan SIVs and their family members begin a next exciting, challenging chapter of opportunity in this country. Just as waves of immigrants before have enriched our nation, these Afghans are already enriching our nation and will continue to.
Senator Tim Kaine of Virginia outside the U.S. Capitol building today. The Senate and House passing on Thursday legislation that provides an additional 8,000 Afghan special immigrant visas and $500 million for the program. That bill expected to be signed into law by President Biden. There are an estimated 70,000 former coalition allies and their families waiting for evacuation under the program. A new congressman was sworn in today, Republican Jake Elzey, winning a special election runoff against another Republican who was endorsed by former President Donald Trump. But the Dallas Morning News says Elzey brushed aside the chatter, saying, "We both had outstanding endorsements. I supported President Trump in 2016 and 2020. He called me on the way down to Austin the other day. We had a wonderful phone call after I won. He couldn't have been nicer." On the U.S. House floor in Washington, after Elzey taking the oath, he was introduced by another Texas congresswoman, Eddie Bernice Johnson.
As Dean of the Texas delegation, it is my honor to welcome to the U.S. House of Representatives Congressman Jake Elzey, who will represent Texas's 6th congressional district. Now, I know that he's only been congressman for a few seconds, but I'm sure that he's already behind on his schedule, and also I'll be very brief. Our beliefs may differ. Our votes may contrast, but I do not doubt for a moment that we share the same commitment to public service and the same sentiment that what we need is consensus builders, people willing to work together regardless of party for the good of the constituents. And given that our two districts are next to each other, I look forward to having a strong working relationship with Congressman Elzey. like I had with the two predecessors, Congressman Joe Barton and the late Congressman Ron Wright. So again, on behalf of the Texas delegations, welcome to the House of Representatives. You are now recognized.
In light of that objection, the gentleman is recognized.
Thank you, Madam Speaker. First of all, I'd like to thank my Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ, my family, my beautiful wife, Shelby, my incredible daughter, McCall, and my incredible son, Jack. My parents in Texas, California, and Papa looking down on me from heaven. I'd like to thank my family in the 6th District of Texas. I will serve you with quiet professionalism. I'd like to read from you Ephesians 4, verses 8 through 9. Finally, brothers and sisters, whatever is true, whatever is honorable, whatever is just, whatever is pure, whatever is lovely, whatever is commendable, if there is any moral excellence, and if there is anything praiseworthy, dwell on these things. Do what you have learned and received and heard from me and seen in me, and the God of peace will be with you. I believe America is exceptional. I love my country. It's an honor to serve. I would appreciate the prayers of all of those in here as I learn my job. And I'd like to leave you with a moment of silence for your colleague, our friend, and my predecessor, Ron Wright, and his family. Thank you, and I yield back.
In light of the administration of the oath of office to the gentleman from Texas, the whole number of the House is now 432.
The House Speaker Nancy Pelosi presiding over the House. The House now has 220 Democrats, 212 Republicans, and those vacancies she mentioned. And that reference to the former Congressman Ron Wright, he died of COVID-19 complications earlier this year, which necessitated the special election in Texas. Olympic officials defending their COVID testing procedures that forced U.S. medal hopeful, one hopeful out of the Tokyo Summer Games after criticism by U.S. Senator Roger Wicker. The athlete is pole vaulter Sam Kendricks from Wicker's home state of Mississippi. Wicker claimed on Thursday that Kendricks' test was a false negative, or a false positive, it was actually negative, and that it's wrong that the rules of the Olympic Committee require that the athlete wait 6 days before getting another test.
I'm not just disappointed, I am outraged. Outraged that a young athlete is unfairly missing out on his chance to show his talent to the world and to win a gold medal on behalf of his country. Aghast that a proud global tradition like the Olympics, a celebration of sport, competition, and international cooperation, has been reduced to testing protocols, rigid rules that are fundamentally unfair, inflexible rules that assume there's no such thing as a false positive. I send my best wishes and congratulations to Sam Kendrick and his family for the good grace they have displayed in the face of this unfair and pointless disqualification. And allow me to state emphatically that I'm not willing to be so gracious. If this action stands, and I hope it will not stand, this hidebound decision by the decision makers at Tokyo should make them ashamed of themselves.
Senator Roger Wicker on the Senate floor on Thursday. And today, a spokesman for the International Olympic Committee, Sam Adams, asked about it by a reporter.
Good morning, Jim Ryan with ABC. Regarding Sam Kendrick, Senator Roger Wicker of Mississippi is demanding that he be retested and be allowed to compete. Is there any chance of that at this point, Mark? Thank you.
Hi. What I would say is that there are very, very strict protocols, as you can imagine, when anyone athlete or whoever proves positive. You will know, I won't talk about individual cases, but if someone tests positive, they will then go through, the saliva will be undergo a PCR test, and then if that still is positive or unclear, then they will go through a proper nasal pharyngeal test, and that is, I understand what happens. I can't talk about the individual case, but that's what happens in all cases. There are very strict protocols, so it's then in the hands. It goes, all the cases are reviewed, but then eventually it obviously goes to the Japanese health authorities, as you'd expect. So he and everyone else will be subject to the same strict protocols, because it's important to give everyone confidence, and for obvious reasons, we can't make exceptions for individuals. Everyone has to follow the rules, I'm afraid.
IOC spokesman Sam Adams at the daily briefing at the Games in Tokyo. Olympic organizers say that so far nearly 200 people connected with the Games have tested positive since July 1st, including 23 athletes, six of whom are from the United States. Carl Levin, Michigan's longest-serving U.S. senator, who died Thursday at age 87, was remembered by family and friends as a man who personified integrity, writes the Detroit Free Press. Congressman Andy Levin, Democrat, said his uncle always put the public good above self-interest and was honored by the trust the people of Michigan put in him. Senator Levin, also a Democrat, served six terms, 36 years, retiring in 2014. And during his farewell speech on the Senate floor, he reflected about how the Senate has changed in the information age.
Making progress in the Senate requires solutions that, while they may not provide anyone with everything they want, are broadly accepted as in the common interest. When compromise is thwarted by ideological rigidity or by abuse of the rights that our rules afford us, the Senate can become paralyzed, unable to achieve the lofty tasks that the founders set before us. Polarization is exacerbated by forces outside this chamber. For instance, we seem to make news more often these days by our responses in the corridors outside this chamber to reporters questioning us about the latest breaking story or rumor than we do by debating and legislating inside this chamber. The viral nature of information and disinformation, and the expectation that public officials will be immediately responsive to every news flash with but a few seconds to think through the implications or consequences or pros and cons has led too often to less thoughtful discourse, and that has helped drive rhetorical wedges between us.
Former Senator Carl Levin, part of his farewell speech in 2014 when he retired, and he died on Thursday. President Biden served with Carl Levin in the Senate for 30 years. He put out a statement calling Levin brilliant, humble, and principled, and one of the most honorable and decent people he has ever known. The two Senate leaders currently also paying tribute to Carl Levin, Chuck Schumer, Democrat, and Mitch McConnell, Republican. We covered it on the C-SPAN networks, as we always do, gavel to gavel with the Senate, and you can find those remarks at our website at cspan.org. And thanks for being with us today. Remember, Washington Today is posted as a podcast. Listen and follow wherever you get your podcasts. Here's wishing you a good night and weekend.